I welcome you all on behalf of ASEAN to this fifth biannual Obeguara Memorial Lecture. And I'm very grateful to Dr. Dylan O'Driscoll, who is there, our camera boy, who organized this event, as they call them, with his usual and extraordinary care and energy. And I also thank our speaker for agreeing to give this talk today, the fifth talk, in memory of Obeguara. Now, who was Obeguara? And I want you to think about Obeguara, who is this person here, this is her photograph. And I want to tell you a few words about Obeguara, to whom this series of biannual lectures is dedicated. Now, Obeguara was one of the founders of the Association for the Study of Ethnicity and Nationalism back in 1990. She was a Nigerian, a young Nigerian woman who came to LSE in the 1980s to do her PhD with Anthony Smith and Percy Coyne. And remembering Obeguara is about remembering and celebrating her life, but also the origins of ASEAN. But it is important to remember Obi not just as this great natural force who helped us, helped ASEAN become this international and leading association of scholars and students who study nationalism, but also it is important to remember her. She was a dear, dear friend of mine, and I'm one of the founders also of ASEAN with her, because she was an outstanding African intellectual. She did her PhD on nation building in Nigeria from 1972 looking at the period 1972 to 1992. And she made a significant contribution to her understanding of the political and religious dynamics of nation building in Nigeria. She was a devout Catholic, and she looked specifically at religious conflict in northern Nigeria. And I'm sure had she survived, had she lived on, because this series of lectures is dedicated to her, because she died 12 years after we had founded ASEAN. She died in a car accident in Nigeria. And we wanted to remember, ASEAN wanted to remember Obi for her contribution to the existence of ASEAN, but also to the understanding of religious conflict in northern Nigeria. And I'm sure that had she lived on, had she not perished, she would have definitely campaigned against the Boko Haram, and she would have stood against it, stood up against it, because she represents a shining example of what a young woman can do with Western education. And I'm very grateful, as I said, to Dr. Smith to be here with us today to preserve the memory of Obeguara. And Dr. Smith is going to talk to us about nationalism in Africa. She's a very distinguished historian of Africa. She specializes in Zimbabwe. She's interested in writing a global history of Africa between 1900 and 1954, and she speaks a lot of African languages, and when I've been talking to her, I would think of Norman Stone, who used to say, students, they know nothing these days, they don't even speak Serbo-Croat. So I think Heike Schmidt will give us an example of the necessity of also learning African languages. So I present to you Dr. Heike Schmidt from the University of Vienna.
Thank you very much, Athena, for this very friendly introduction and for reminding us of Obeguara's contribution to African studies and the lost potential as she passed away so early on. What I would like to do today is invite you as a first step to Zimbabwe, in particular to Eastern Zimbabwe, and the year is 1985. Sorry, we don't have a clicker, so I'll probably be running back and forth quite a bit. Do you mind doing that? So 1985, Eastern Zimbabwe, it's election year. In Mutasa district, there are two main opponents standing for parliamentary elections, two opponents who could not have been more different from each other. One is Victoria Chitepo. She was running for the ruling party, ZANU-PF, a party which has been headed by Robert Mugabe for quite some time. Victoria Chitepo at that point of time in 1985, as she stood election in Mutasa district, had lived in Zimbabwe for not more than 13 years. She's South African originally. She married Herbert Chitepo, the first practicing African lawyer in Zimbabwe, and I use the contemporary word at the time, Southern Rhodesia, in the 1950s. And then she spent the rest of the colonial period in exile and returned to Zimbabwe in 1980, when the ruling party invited her, that might be a way of phrasing it, to join the government and serve the government. The government in particular suggested that she should run for elections in Mutasa district because her husband was born there, and in fact it was around that time when there was a reform of local government that the district council was introduced in Mutasa district, and it was named Chitepo District Council, something which caused quite a bit of resentment in the area. As you can see on this street sign, the true crossroads in many ways, Mutasa Chitepo District Council, because the district was called Mutasa District, as I've been referring to quite a number of times already just now. Now, Mutasa District, the name Mutasa will appear quite a number of times in my lecture today. Victoria Chitepo's opponent in these elections, 1985, was King Itai David Mutasa, somebody who was born into the Mutasa royal family, somebody who ran not for the ruling party, clearly he was your opponent, he ran for the UANC, the United African National Council, Muzureva's party. 3 years before 1982, his older brother had been installed as, to use an English term for it, paramount chief before the onset of colonial rule. Probably the English translation would have been king in the area. Why did King David Itai David Mutasa choose to run for elections in 1985 against Victoria Chitepo? Well, his main argument was, I can't allow to have an in-law represent us. She was merely married into the area, and it is my responsibility that the son of the soil, somebody from the area, somebody whose role it is to exert patronage over those from here, that this somebody like me will represent this area in parliament. Now, the outcome of the elections, any of us who are interested in elections, I will not even comment on it. I will just give you the numbers. Victoria Chitepo won 94% according to official numbers. I think we all have an opinion whether it's possible to have fair and free elections and for a candidate to actually win 94%. KID, or to use the acronym, King Itai David Mutasa won 5%. So he lost the election. What I will do in this lecture, the title says Nationalism in Africa, and I will attempt to make broad arguments about nationalism in Africa. What I will focus on is Zimbabwe, and in particular, this one man, King Itai David Mutasa, who is known to his family, who's known to his friends, and I hesitate to say to his enemies, is KID, his initials. The question I wish to answer in this lecture is, what makes a nationalist? What makes a nationalist in terms of political thought, in terms of experience, and in terms of actions? I will draw on John Lonsdale's concept of moral ethnicity, this idea that he proposed in the early 1990s that ethnic identity, ethnicity, if we define it as moral ethnicity, and national identity are the same, that both denote the belonging and self-chosen belonging to a political community, and that the central important value that is being negotiated as we wish to belong to a political community is civic virtue, what makes us a valued member of this political community. Now, what I wish to address in this lecture by raising this question, what makes a nationalist, is to address two challenges, and one that African history has been facing since its beginnings. One is the resistance paradigm. What that stands for is the binary understanding of the colonial period that sees African men and women facing the choice between either collaborators with the colonial project or resistors against it. The criticism of this kind of writing of African colonial history dates back to at least the early 1990s. So the criticism has been around quite a while, even though that kind of history within the resistance paradigm, this binary world, you're either a collaborator or a resistor, is still being produced. And I would like to take up this challenge, as others have before me in the last 20 years, to pluralize resistance and say there are many ways of resisting colonial rule. And I would like to illustrate that through the life of KID. I would also take up the second challenge set very recently by Jean Allman, historian of Ghana, who argues that there is a continued grand narrative of decolonization, that there still is a predominant a meta-narrative of a singular linear story. And she ends her piece where she asks the question, can we recount the story of decolonization so that it is neither a triumphal end nor a tragic beginning? And what I will attempt in this lecture is to answer with a resounding, yes, we can. And I apologize for the pun, and I've been a yes for a while. This yes, we can, again, I wish to locate in the biography of David Mutasa. So what I would like to do in the time I have is address three aspects which I think are important to consider when we look at nationalism. One is self-improvement and opportunity, one aspiration and belonging. Now, just as a warning, as I get into the meat of this lecture, I will not spend equal time on all of them. So not to worry if I spend more time on one, I will try to stick to the time I'm given here. So as you know, when I was asked to provide an image for the poster that was put together by the LSE for this event, it was very easy for me to choose this image of African teachers, a missionary image that was taken in the 1930s by missionaries of the United Methodist Church. It was easy for two reasons. One, I just found it and researched during research in Zimbabwe in January, so it was very fresh on my mind, but also it cuts to the core of the first part of my argument. Now, if you look at these mission photographs of African men who are celebrated as mission success, and there are really three different genres. You see African men with bicycles, you see African men in groups to show and demonstrate the sheer number, success of the missionary effort in numbers. We have so many converts, we have so many teachers, we have so many catechists. And then maybe most importantly, the photograph of an African man with his family to demonstrate that we have succeeded, we as missionaries, so I'm using missionary we here, I want to be clear on that, we have succeeded in producing an entire Christian family that then reproduces the Christian ideal and the civilizing mission through the generations. So usually a family posing with children to show that there's a future generation of Christians coming. To just briefly to illustrate, so very often it's a single man named with a bicycle, in this case, Reverend David Mandisodza. The one image I found of a woman with a bicycle is one of a midwife, and just anecdotally and as an aside, I only found one single, among thousands of photographs, only found one image of a woman, African woman with a bicycle. And anybody who's familiar with Zimbabwe knows that even today it's considered to be inappropriate for women to cycle. At the time, in the 1930s, there was a debate, as others have shown, Betsy Schmidt has shown that in her work, between African men missionaries and the colonial state, African older men demanding to control African women's mobility that had increased with the onset of colonial infrastructure, such as the building of railway lines. So moralizing the use of bicycles was very much part of that discourse, saying African women should not use bicycles. It's indecent, so very rare image here. I could not resist this one. The quality is not great, but I think it's just an amazing image, which again shows, you know, here are missionaries who are trying to make a point to show, you know, this is our mission success. We've converted so many people, not just to Christianity, but all these men are teachers and preachers. And you can show your whole lineup, and they all have their bicycles, and they're all on their road to colonial modernity and colonial modernization. But back to the first image. So what we see in these photographs, one perspective, is that of the missionaries who took the photographs, the missionaries who put them in photograph albums to demonstrate both in the colony as well as home the mission success. So the caption for this is "Off on an Errand of Love," which is kind of tongue-in-cheek, because the captions in the photograph album where I found this particular image tend to be rather, you know, Reverend so-and-so, nurse on her way to work, twins being born. But this is kind of tongue-in-cheek, but it also, again, shows this attempt, this mission perspective of the success of the civilizing mission, and this, what appeared from the missionary's perspective, rather grand obstacle of converting African men. It tended to be easier in this first and second generation after the arrival of mission Christianity to convert African women, but to convert African men and to commit them to monogamous Christian marriages, to commit them to what the missionaries thought of as a Christian household, tended to be the bigger obstacle. So it's one interpretation of this particular caption would be, well, maybe it was just a joke, you know, off on an errand of love, you know, makes you the fancy young man with your bicycle. But it also speaks to what missionaries wanted to achieve. And it also speaks to a social and economic reality that these were the new men who had their own economic means, who could marry without the support of their families, who could raise bright wealth without the help of their fathers, providing cattle in the negotiation of marriage arrangements. They were themselves cash wage earners as teachers, working for the missions, working for the colonial administration. So there are a lot of ways of reading this kind of image. What I think is particularly important and where I would like to take us with this argument, however, and where I will do this from now on, is switch to an African perspective. After all, I'm a historian of Africa, I'm not a colonial historian. For some men who chose this path of Western education, which usually meant mission education, of colonial modernity and modernization, this might very well have meant improvement. It might very well have meant excelling as far as possible within the constraints of colonial rule. I'm just mentioning this for those of you who may be familiar with Zimbabwean history. It's not surprising that during the Liberation War of the 1970s, if you look at who was targeted among the civilian population by the guerrilla fighters, was the colonial chiefs, it was store owners and teachers, because they were seen as collaborators with the colonial state. But having said this, and the argument I like to carry here is that for many of these young men and women, it was a path to self-improvement. John Iliffe argued as early as 1969, he's a frustrating historian because he developed some of these ideas so early on that's taken some of us much, much longer to get to. So he argued as early as 1969, the man who fought his way through school was not passively accepting colonial rule. Improvement was not normally something Europeans did for Africans. It was something Africans did for Africans. So 1969, based in Dar es Salaam at the time, John Iliffe very much wrote in the mode of what his colleague Terry Ranger phrased, the African initiative. This was not something, it was not an improvement that missionaries of the colonial state brought to Africa, and that was bought wholesale, copied, mimicked. No, it was something that became African, African choices, African initiative. John Iliffe, in the same year and in the same piece of writing, shaped this phrase that has accompanied us as historians of Africa for a long time now. He referred to the time period from the early years of the 20th century to 1945 as the age of improvement and differentiation. His argument is that in these early decades of colonial rule, there was an opening of a window of opportunity for these young men who embraced Christianity, who embraced Western education, who embraced the colonial economy, and who in fact became the so-called new men. In the French colonial context, referred to as évolués, the developed ones, very derogatory term. He also emphasized it was not just an age of improvement, but also of differentiation. That these new men could, as I mentioned before, for example, marry on their own terms without having to reference back to their families. There was economic mobility. There was the possibility of setting yourself apart from your social and economic background in which you grew up. The new young man in the meta-narrative, which Jean Allman says we need to break, or she asks, can we break it? These new young men became nationalists when they realized the boundaries of, to refer to Homi Bhabha's colonial mimicry, becoming similar but not the same, anglicized but not English. You could only go so far in being a new man. You were never a you were always a subject, you were never a citizen. And those boundaries were very quickly seen by these men who explored these worlds of education, of Christianity and the colonial economy. Now, John Iliffe, and it's a little unfair to again refer to him, considering this is something he argued in 1969, but it is important because it still does characterize the literature, or a large part of the literature, of course, not everything. But John Iliffe said improvement was changing into nationalism. So, as these new men realized the boundaries of how far they could go, they became politicized. And what I would like to argue in this lecture is that it did not necessarily change from one into the other. On the contrary, if self-improvement were chosen, it could be a central part of nationalism. It could go hand in hand. One did not have to replace the other. And I would like to illustrate this through the lives, as I said, of Kenyatta David Mutasa and his wife Joyner. So again, Kenyatta David Mutasa is known as KID, and I'm going to use the acronym much as I loathe acronyms usually from now on. Born in 1929, KID was born into the royal Mutasa family. What that means is he was born with the totem of Shumba, which means lion. But he was not just born into any branch of the royal family, he was born very close to the heart of succession. And I'm just going to say this quickly. His father was the eldest son of the eldest son of the king who ruled at the turn of the 19th to the 20th century. So the direct succession line that his branch of the family claimed led directly to KID's father. And for those of you who are familiar with Zimbabwean history, there were two polities, two states that existed at the time of colonial conquest. There were two rulers who signed treaties with the British. One was Lobengula of the Matabele kingdom, and the other was King Tendai, who was the Mutasa in eastern Zimbabwe. Now, in KID's early years, I would like to argue, there were two influences on his political thinking. And one, and this is something one does not often find in the study of nationalism, were the succession disputes his family was involved in. As I said, there was the expectation that his father would succeed to the throne, but he failed. And there were several succession disputes. The most contested one was in 1943, when KID was 14 years old. So probably very impressionable at that age, a teenager, the fourth-born son, so he would not expect to have ruled himself. This was not for himself. He would be supporting his father, and this tremendous disappointment when his entire family, by this I mean this branch of the family, expected his father would come to rule, and that did not happen in 1943. And the next dispute was in 1958, where as a grown-up man of 29 years old, he became very active helping his father compose letters to the colonial administration and so on. KLD was deeply frustrated by what he perceived to be a great injustice between both the colonial state that was very present in this in these succession disputes, but also betrayed by the other branches of the royal family that did not allow his father to rule. There were several factors that came together. The notion that it was his father's birthright, the notion that it was the right of his line of the royal family, and quite importantly, what I think shaped him as a young boy was that KID and his brothers and sisters, for that matter, grew up with who at one point of time was an incredibly powerful chieftainess and the senior woman in the royal family, Mredla. And I interviewed both an older brother and a younger brother of KID, who told me that as little boys they were sitting, she was old by then, and she was living with KID's father because she had lost her land to the colonial state, and she was old, she was getting frail, so KID's father was looking after her, she was living with them, and you know, little kids would sit around her feet and listen to stories of the greatness of the empire that once existed before the onset of colonial rule, and how it is that KID's father was the right heir. And they told me stories of how they would tease the old woman when she would fall asleep, tear up little pieces of cloth tied around her toes, set them on fire so the old woman would wake up again and then run away so she couldn't hit them, but then she was awake and she could tell them more stories because she was full of all this historical, she was the depository of historical knowledge. And this very much then shaped why KID was so invested in that it was his family, it was his father who should rule, and after his father, his oldest brother. The second influence in early years on his political thinking was KID's disillusionment with the missionaries. To cut a very long story short, KID's father embraced the United Methodist Church, which was in the area in competition with the Anglican Church. And one can see that through the generations, you know, his father, his uncle, the siblings could really be seen as poster children of the first and second generation of converts to Christianity. At the same time, his father, Masavara, and as it turns out, and I would like to mention this here, his wife's mother, who was in her area the first African woman who converted to Christianity, also to the Methodist Church, they were very strict on discipline, very strict on saying never be idle, always, always, always work on improving yourself and to ensure that when you have children, that they will have a better life than you have. Always strive for improvement. They grew up from early childhood with this mantra. So it's no surprise that KID, as his siblings, went for mission education. He went for teacher training, and as he went to the main Methodist mission station, Old Mutare, where African young men and women, well, didn't depend on age, but African men and women could train for to become teachers. He found himself in the same class with a young woman with the name of Joyna Maua. And the two of them, it was always one year, one term he was number one term she was number one. So they were competing. Each wanted to outdo the other. And they were so close with their academic achievements. And it seemed there was quite a bit of competition going on. And lo and behold, as they graduated in 1953, they married. And personally, I like all the pictures I chose for us. I was about to say I really like this particular picture. Why am I talking about disillusionment with missionaries? KID expected recognition. He came out number one of his year, Joyner number two. And what did the missionaries do? They sent him to a minor, far away, really remote school to teach. Not found any evidence why that decision was made, but he was really, really disappointed. He felt betrayed. He felt all this effort he had put into it, and now he's sent to this place far away. So after a few months, he decided that's not what he wanted. And he and Joyner went to teach on a farm school, and then shortly after, taught at a government school. So he completely distanced himself for quite some time from the mission school system, and in particular also from the Methodist Church, other than to further his education. So what we see as we move on, and again this is under the heading of self-improvement and differentiation, is that both KID and his wife Joyner used the tools of colonial modernity and modernization, in fact the civilizing mission, for their own purposes. One example, and here I'm jumping way out of the time frame where I am right now, Joyner wrote three books after independence for African girls and women that were mostly used in schools, a cookbook, a dressmaking book, and one on how to establish and run women's clubs. So this idea of self-improvement, you know, do something for yourself but help others to lift themselves up, very much was something that they pursued after they distanced themselves, and in particular KID did, after they graduated from school in 1953. So again, once again, back to ILF. My argument here is it's not a shift from improvement to nationalism, it's self-improvement with nationalism, and I hope to illustrate this in the next part. Just a quick sip of water. There's one piece of political writing I found by KID, which he wrote while he was in exile, which I'm going to get to in a minute. It's entitled, Remember, History Repeats, also for Zimbabwe. And I've edited it a little and shortened it a little. Praise goes to all Zimbabweans in all quarters of the earth, scratching and thinking. Fear not, history repeats itself, as it did for other nations and countries. As for us, considered politically backward and retarded, as the English, during the glory of the Roman Empire, should not be despised, but encouraged and befriended and convinced of forging ahead to victory. For us to advance, we should cling to our culture and test it against others. A people without culture loses their identity, has no pride, and is in disarray, consequently easily falling victim of the enemy. The enemy is among us in full swing operation. We know the enemy by our fears and chains. Our land is the spoil of white conquerors, and in the Second World War, excluding us who died in our hundreds for an exploiter's badge. Our land is the fishing ground of seekers of fortune. You and we help them in our ways. Sure, we the natives were tortured and butchered, our children imprisoned, our wives raped. We have nowhere to appeal but to ourselves. This means hard work. Work means for the nation, nothing less. The principle that natives are second-class citizens was proved wrong in Botswana, Kenya, Malawi, Uganda, Tanzania, Zambia, and in all distant countries. It shall be proved once for all in Zimbabwe. Let us prepare ourselves, marching to war, realizing that to everything there is a limitation of time. Time to sow and time to harvest. Time to learn and time to impart that which is learned above all, time to act. Therefore, let our whole be directed to action. For our land is the source of food and education and dignity. He wrote that probably in 1970, a passionate nationalist call for action to recover the lost lands, but in rhetoric very different from the nationalist calls we find at the center of the liberation movement at this time as the war for liberation was fought, where it was the call for the lost ancestral lands, not the land that gives education and dignity. If you think and refer to Renan's famous Sorbonne lecture, Qu'est-ce qu'une nation, what is a nation? The elements Renan identified that make for nationalism and nationalist thought, we find them all in this piece of political writing. The sentiment is there, and the suffering, the women raped, the children tortured. It is certainly self-ascribed, only we can act. The emphasis of unity. KRD refers to culture, but it's not tribal. It's not ethnic. It's recognizing who we want to be and who we are and where we come from together. The source lays bare for us KRD's political thinking. But, and this is what I want to explore in this part of the lecture, he was never a nationalist who stood on a soapbox or filled stadiums with thousands of people listening to him. After the disillusionment with the mission, KRD and Joyner, as I mentioned before, settled to teach at a government primary school. In Yanyadzi, they had their children, first their son Lincoln in 1954, and then three more children, Chipo, Shingai, and Shomo. They were thriving, settling into a family life, both teaching. They opened a general store. This was a rural area, a growth point at a major thoroughfare. And then almost as soon as they arrived there, this particular growth point, Nyanyadzi, became a hotbed of rural nationalism. Those of you familiar with Zimbabwean history will have heard the name Dabaningi Sithole, who was a major nationalist at that time in the 1950s. Before him, from Benjamin Burumbo to the Southern Rhodesian ANC, the nationalists, as they were traveling through the country addressing people in the rural areas, tended to stop in Nyanyadzi. But it was in particular Dabaningi Sithole, who came from an area nearby, who befriended KID and found a close ally in him, who decided to regularly hold rallies in this particular small settlement that basically only distinguishes itself because it had an irrigation scheme, which was a colonial modernization project. And today is very noticeable because it's close to the diamond fields and has a Wild West feel to it. What I would like to argue in this part of the lecture is that looking at KRD and Joyner's time in Nyanyadzi, it is possible to challenge the master narrative of nationalism in Zimbabwe. So here I'm moving us very specifically into Zimbabwean history. Part of the master narrative of nationalism in Zimbabwe is that 1960 was this big, important year. 1960 was the year when mass nationalism turned to militancy. We then, and I apologize that I mentioned so many parties, they kept being banned and refounded under different names and at times rather different, with different political agendas. So this is not central to the argument if you're not particularly interested in Zimbabwe. But in 1960, the then nationalist party, the NDP, the National Democratic Party, was banned. And it was this combination of, you know, in South Africa, we have Sharpeville, we have the ANC founding Umkhonto we Sizwe, the armed wing, we have a move towards the liberation war in South Africa, we have the white supremacist state in Zimbabwe at the time, Rhodesia, Southern Rhodesia, also showing that they were preparing to go quite far, the banning of the NDP, we have urban unrest in the major cities, Harare and Bulawayo, which was called G. And that is why historians say this was this important year. However, if we look at it through the lens of KRD's experiences in Nyanyadzi, one can make quite a different argument. KRD entered nationalist politics once he and Joyner moved to Nyanyadzi. He joined the African National Congress of Southern Rhodesia. He was elected chairman for the district. And then came what I would argue was a much more, well, at least equally important, if not more important turning point than 1960, and that was February 1959. What happened was that there, at the time, Southern Rhodesia belonged to the Central African Federation together with Nyasaland, today Malawi, and Northern Rhodesia, today Zambia. There were riots in Malawi, there were riots in Zambia, and the Rhodesian government decides to declare the emergency. And as part of that, roughly 1,200 people are arrested and put into detention. I hesitate to say people because the vast majority were men, and there needs to be a more thoroughly gendered account of what actually happened. This is not where I want to take the argument. Where I want to take the argument is if you look at it through KRD's eyes and other elders now in their 80s who I interviewed and their family members. It was that moment when the Land Rover arrives at night or early in the morning, the police get out, they hammer on the door, and they drag the family father out, throw him in the back of the Land Rover, drive off, and the children and the wives don't know what's going to happen. It's just this moment of absolute rupture and suffering that is very prominent still to this day in what was the moment when things really changed during the Nationalist period. It was when the father was taken away. We did not know what would happen. So 59, if you consider that more than 1,000 people were put into detention, that was a large, large measure that affected so many families. Now the second element, and I'm just going to go over that quite quickly, is that usually the beginning of the liberation war in Zimbabwe, well, the government dates it to 1966 with the Battle of Chinoy. Historians sometimes 1972, as I have myself in the past, I'm revising my own work here, because that was not the beginning of the war, but that was the period when it stepped up to full guerrilla-style insurgency. It is no coincidence that the first guerrilla gang that operated in this liberation war was the Crocodile Gang, fancy name, and it was from Nyanyadzi and operated in Nyanyadzi. So if you look at why Nyanyadzi, what was going on there? Davinini Sithole, as a very prominent politician already at that time, as I said, focused on holding rallies there and interviewing elders, you know, talking to octogenarians and septuagenarians now. It is amazing to see two things. One is just still the memory of the amazement. So there was this African man in a suit with a tie, with a driver and a car, which was not common in the 50s and early 60s. And he would stand up and he would eloquently speak in English, which not everybody understood. But it was not about the content, it was about the charisma. It was about believing that there was something else, something one can aspire to. And the other element to it is that already at that time, already in the 1950s, and there's no research we've done so far on this, there was systematically planned sabotage. So talking to octogenarians whose eyes are lighting up and saying, you know, and then Sithole came by and he were trained how to do pipe bombs. And then we decided, you know, we had that meeting. We said, that policeman, he's particularly vicious. He always beats everybody up he arrests. So we're going to get him. And the whole system was set up, how to go about it, which I'm going to skip over now for time reasons. But that is something which the historiography has been silent on. It doesn't fit into the hyper-nationalist narrative of we fought a liberation war, it was Mao's style, it was ZANU's liberation armed wing. It's a different story that can be told as well, that militarily had very little impact, but for those who experienced it and those who participated in it, it's something that very much carries what this time period stands for. So let me move on with KRD. KRD was sent into, let's just skip over that, over the next one. I'm just going to, just to mention this, Davinini Sithole, and I just want to make a quick point about that. You can keep going on now, names. So here's KRD's eldest brother, Davinini Sithole, at the ZANU inaugural congress. That's the predecessor of today's ruling party. Davinini Sithole at that point was president of the party. And the reason I've chosen this, you know, KRD making this argument about the importance of culture, of knowing who you are, And part, as I said, of this nationalist appeal Sithole held was that he was very charismatic. But part of what I think has also not been investigated very much is the cultural language that was spoken. By that, I mean, you know, also in body language. And so if you just look at this, the eating center in Nyama and me, and you have the oldest brother, Dr. Elisha Mutasa, you might not notice this photograph. If you look at this one, and you notice that Dominique Sithole is sitting on a log of wood. So he's elevated. You don't want to see him, but if you see it, he is elevated above the other man. And in Shona cultural understanding, you show respect to somebody by keeping your head lower. Now, if you sit on the same level, then it can be a little exhausting. So usually, you know, you would literally elevate the person who has a higher status. And this cultural language was part of showing respect, establishing respect, having your voice heard, you know, in a very little gesture, showing, well, it's very clear who is in charge, even though Dr. Elisha Mutasa at that point of time was also a very important man. So I just want to quickly go. Now, moving on quickly. After detention, it became quite clear to KID that it was time to leave the country. He knew he wouldn't be safe. So he decided to leave for London, but he didn't have the funds to do that. And he was always a very enterprising man, which I'm going to get into in the remainder of this lecture in some detail. So it happened to be that in 1960, one of the most revered musicians in the entire region, not just in Southern Africa, was Dorothy Masuka. And she was from Zimbabwe. She made her career in South Africa, and the South African regime in 1960 deported her. So she suddenly arrived in Zimbabwe, and KID heard about this, and he thought, I need to raise some funds. There's an artist out of work. What can we do? So he approached her. They never met before. He approached her and said, what do you think about re-establishing your career by doing a tour? And he put it together with a band, and they toured the whole of, you know, they went to Malawi, Zambia, even the Congo, Mozambique, toured throughout Zimbabwe, and they raised enough money for everybody involved so that KID had enough resources to move to London. It was not enough to bring his family yet, but he could move. So now we're getting into the London years. The diaspora of nationalists has been very much under-researched, specifically for Zimbabwe nationalism, but more generally also. And what we see, and I'm going to start with a narrative and come to the argument in a minute. So 1961, KID leaves for London. He takes up a range of different jobs and always at the same time keeps continuing with his education as well. He completes his O-levels, then he starts earning university degrees, and as soon as he's earned enough money, he starts working as a chauffeur, but then once he's earned degrees, he starts working as an accountant, a credit controller, and then he brings his family, first his wife Joyner, and then eventually his four children to London as well. With the help of his oldest brother, he manages to buy this house in Highgate in London, and it becomes the center of his political activity. He briefly returned to Zimbabwe in 1964 to attend, we just saw the photographs, ZANU's inaugural Congress. He joined the party in its very first beginnings in 1963 and was already appointed, but now in 1964 he was confirmed, and I have to read this title, as first and chief representative for ZANU in Western Europe. Nothing less than that. And I've seen the document. What was his task as ZANU's European representative? Well, one was to travel. So he met Fidel Castro, he went to China, he went to Moscow, he met European leaders, he met members of the British government. But most importantly, there were two tasks he had to fulfill as European representative. One was fundraising, and he spent in particular quite a lot of time in Scandinavia fundraising both for the Rhodesian Students Trust and also more broadly for the war effort. And he was founder and director of the Rhodesian Students' Trust in 1967. Now this so far has been an untold story, and I'm most grateful to the family to have drawn my attention to it and to have supported my research by giving me access to KRD's papers and for allowing me to interview them. Rhodesian Students' Trust, in a nutshell, served to bring young Zimbabwean men and women to the UK during these years from 1967 to the late 1970s. Remember, Zimbabwe only gained independence in 1980. And the purpose was to say, well, we have all these young people who crossed the border to join the Liberation War, to be trained as guerrilla fighters, but we also need to think of the future. What is Zimbabwe going to be after independence? We will have to have academically trained men and women. So the purpose of the Rhodesian Students' Trust was to bring young Zimbabwean men and women to the UK to raise funding for them and have them study at British universities. And the tremendous success of this trust is that more than 2,000 Zimbabweans were brought to the UK through the Rhodesian Students' Trust. And if you look at the list of names, it's a who's who in Zimbabwe. Interestingly, not necessarily the political elite, but people who came with the business degrees, quite a number of them, I should mention, working at the University of Reading, came to the University of Reading, but it was throughout the UK that these young men and women studied. Anything from agriculture, nutrition, nursing, business degrees, accounting, anything where one would think it might be useful. And just to mention one person, the current deputy governor of the Reserve Bank, Mrs. Levayo, also studied at the University of Reading. And if you look at, you know, these were people who in 1980 were then appointed as ambassadors, joining their ministries as technocrats on the banks and so on. So very importantly, the political goal here was not to think about how do we achieve independence, what nationalism usually is about, you know, how do we achieve the nation state, how do we achieve the freedom to realize the nation. The political vision was what happens afterwards. Who do we want to be as an independent nation? And the decision that part of that had to be to have an educated elite. This house, 15 Gallia Road in Highgate, sorry, 14 Gallia Road, I should know this by heart by now, Gallia Road in Highgate, was humming with people. At one point, I was told there were more than 40 people living in there. And it was Joyna who kept food on the table. She took on jobs teaching evening school. She also furthered her education while all of this going on, bringing up her own four children. And then as these young men and women transitioned into the UK, you know, first bringing them into this house and then, you know, finding them studentships and getting them into British universities. So, in addition to all of this, this project of self-improvement KRD and Joyna were following, as I said and as I argued at the very beginning today, was still something that for them was integral to what they pursued as being nationalist. Can we just go on to the next one? So KRD established Shumba Holdings. Shumba, the Shona word for lion. He always was tongue-in-cheek naming his business after the royal totem. It was a supermarket, and then down this door, to the next one, there was the Lion's Den, the nightclub to go in London. They also opened a West Indian restaurant, so business was there. And at the height of the Liberation War in Zimbabwe, 1976, 1977, as thousands of children and young adults crossed the borders to join and fight for Zimbabwe's liberation, that was the time when KRD, also in London, became particularly radicalized. He took Joyner and his children every week to Fasimba meetings. That was the Black Consciousness Movement in London that existed between 69 and 74 and was very closely watched by Special Branch. And it's quite intriguing to think that, you know, he aligned himself with Fasimba. He aligned himself with this Pan-Africanist movement, with a radical movement, and then leaves ZANU. changes the political party in 1976. And he becomes, he leaves ZANU and he joins the party I mentioned at the beginning, for which he ran for office in 1985, the United African National Council, which was led by Bishop Abel Muzuewa. Now, I don't want to get deep into Zimbabwean politics here, looking slightly nervously at the time. Just to say, in 1976, the Geneva Conference was convened. It was Henry Kissinger, as Secretary of State of the US, who pursued this road of attempting a negotiated peace. KRD attended. And it was at that point, and there were certainly other contributing factors, which I'm not going to go into right now, but it was at that point where he shifted from thinking, you know, I'm a member of ZANU, this is one of the two parties that pursued the liberation war, and where he shifted his emphasis entirely to what is going to happen after independence is achieved. And he divorces himself from the liberation war by doing that. So that leads me to my last section, belonging. A short section, I promise. Now, belonging, I hope it has been clear, is cut across through all the themes I've introduced. In 1979, KRD sells the house in Highgate. He and Joyner ship their possessions. The children who are still at university stay behind to complete their degrees. And it is important that they return to Zimbabwe before the war has ended, before independence. So if you look at a narrative of freedom for Zimbabwe, then we have a national narrative, which is Independence Day, April 1980, the British flag goes down, the Zimbabwean flag goes up, Prince Charles has tears in his eyes, as many eyewitnesses say, it was due to tear gas rather than seeing the British flag going down, but who knows, that's the moment of joy. For many ex-combatants, it was the moment they went, ceasefire was declared in December 1979, and they had to present themselves, not all of them did, but many did, to assembly points, and they were disarmed. But for KRD and Joyner and others, it was 1979. It was clear that the war would end. It was still being fought, but it was clear at the point it would end. And Zimbabwe was wide open in opportunities. The racial laws of segregation were increasingly removed, and it was economically open as many of the white settlers left. So there were properties for sale, opportunities to be taken up. So just very quickly, what did KRD pursue upon his return with Joyner to Zimbabwe? He bought urban property, he bought a commercial farm with a tremendously, actually the most successful piggery in the country, although he faced racist and racialized problems in marketing. On this farm he had, I have to mention this, a breeding bull, which he named Lucky. He started an import-export company in which he worked with his younger daughter and younger son, Shigai and Chomo. He served as a manager on another commercial farm for an African-initiated church and self-help society, Zivizano. And in 1982, finally, his line of the royal family rules, and his older brother, Abisha, is appointed as Mambo, as, although we want to translate this, paramount chief. And he assists his brother in achieving this, and also later in his duties. In those years after independence, we see a passionate man in his letters. Impressive rhetoric, he's proud, he has a decisive stance in his dealings towards administration and local government. KRD and Joyner certainly succeeded in providing the opportunities for the children to have better lives than they had. But yet, to come back to Allman, this is not altogether a happy ending. He loses the elections in 1985. His older brother is installed as, let's call it, paramount chief in 1982. But this is contested, so this does still not fully establish the right by his line and the royal family to rule in the future. And then keep just going. Yeah, this is a happy picture from he's on his commercial farm. One more, please. And then both of them pass away on the same day within hours in 1994, passing away quite young. So in conclusion, this lecture addressed the question of what makes a nationalist. It started with Jean Armand's question, can we recount the story of decolonization so that it is neither a triumphal end nor a tragic beginning? What I've tried to do is provide two answers to that question. One is to refer to Eric Hobsbawm's call that we need to study nationalism both top-down and bottom-up. What about the middle? The story of KRD and Joyner is the story of the middle. KRD was a nationalist who did not stand on a soapbox, he did not stand on the stage, he did not hold party office, he had no intention of joining the government beyond running for office in 1985. But he was also not the bottom-up study of the women, the peasants, the poor, the urban poor, the rural poor. No, these men and women in the middle who played crucial roles in nationalism, I think, allow us new perspectives on understanding it. Secondly, John Ives' argument about the age of improvement and differentiation is brilliant, not just for his time, and has shaped the historiography to this day. But differentiation did not begin with colonial rule. The story I've told you of KID is the story of somebody born into a royal family, somebody whose perspective, whose political outlook, his thinking, his experience, and his actions were in part shaped by seeing himself as a member of a royal family. So I think it is important to widen that perspective, to consider the differentiation in new ways. And just to mention it, I think there's also a blind spot here in John Lonsdale's concept of moral ethnicity. So let me close with KRD's words. A people without culture loses their identity. We have nowhere to appeal but to ourselves. This means hard work. Work means for the nation, nothing less. Therefore, let our whole be directed to action, for our land is a source of food and education and dignity. And as a final remark, KRD could have done nothing of what he did, especially doing so many different things, his businesses, his political activities, his political dreams, without his wife Joyner, who did not just stand by his side, but who carried a very heavy load in this whole enterprise. Thank you for your attention.
My name is Matt Lazoa. I'm chairing the event, and my apologies for being late. Being an old generation LSE, I went to St. Clement's Room 502, but this is actually Clement House 502, so that is explaining the discrepancy in time. Thank you, Heike, for the extensive explanation of how this historical trajectory goes. It's quite poignant, actually, that she chose to talk about Zimbabwe, because we know that the independence, nationalists who led the country to independence, Robert Mugabe, is still the current president and now the chair of the African Union. So when we talk about aspiration, self-improvement, and belonging, it epitomizes that. So we're going to open it up now for questions, and I'm sure I can say that there will be some political questions in addition to the historical.
Yes.
So I hope you're prepared for all that.
Bracing myself.
Okay, now it's your time to speak. It's your turn.
How inclusive was he about the white, etc., in his vision of the future of Zimbabwe?
Mm-hmm. That's a really interesting question, and it cuts to also the core of his family's understanding of responsibility and civic virtue. It really brings me back to this notion of civic virtue in a number of ways. He's, as a nationalist, very inclusive. And if you look at the family photograph album, which I've had the pleasure to do, you see a number of photographs before independence and then after independence of white supporters, for example, visiting him in Joyna. So people from Scandinavia who he got to know. That's not quite your question, I realize that. But you're very warm, loving, clearly close friends beyond shared political interests, reflected in that, and also in the correspondence at the time, and then leading into years after independence. After independence, his experience with the piggery, with marketing, you know, he was that kind of man, he was that kind of visionary, where he said, I want a commercial farm, where's there a gap in the market? Pigs. And I want to be the number one producer of pork in the country. And he builds it up and he succeeds, but he struggles to market it and he runs into racial prejudice. And that, it seems, quite embittering. So within Zimbabwe itself, he experienced limits to what could be done in the early years after independence, after 1980. And I suspect that that was something that concerned him leading up to that, to independence as well, because his political vision was what happened afterwards. And I said, this cuts also to the core of the civic virtue within the family. There's this notion of his oldest brother, who it was expected would follow his father or would be the next in the line of succession. He passed away in 1970, very young. Many men in the family, unfortunately, passed away very young. He married in his second marriage a white British woman, to use it, probably term white. And the family was very unhappy with that. So I don't have any specific evidence of what KID was thinking, but there was this notion, if you are the ruling family, you have to marry within, you can't marry outside. So I think that for him probably went hand in hand, that he would have always preferred to deal within his own moral realm. I'm not sure I answer your question, but...
he didn't intend to chase the whites away.
No.
Why did he leave some, actually?
Yeah. Well, as I said, I think part of it was... sorry, I didn't
mean to... Well, no, I was just thinking of that in the 1980 elections, ZANU got most of the seats,
yes.
And the UANC actually only got 3 seats,
yes.
As I remember.
Yes.
As regards to the previous question, I don't think ZANU welcomed white members, actually, but the UANC did. I don't know whether that's in any way relevant to my question, but I'm just interested to know why he left ZANU after being in the party for, 13 years
or
so.
And a founding member,
And
the UANC actually won seats through the white role, just because of the Lancaster House Agreement. The original Lancaster House Agreement, the peace agreement stipulated, brokered by the British government, that for 10 years there would be a separate, the so-called general role, electors role, and then white role. And it was some white voters actually voted for the UANC, seeing them as a preferred alternative to the former liberation movements. I don't have any direct evidence. What I know is that he attended the Geneva Conference, and I think it was this context of being at peace negotiations that brought to him this notion, this war can actually end, there is an alternative to it. I need to think ahead, I need to prepare for what comes afterwards. So that there's an early letter from 1978 where he states his intention of forming this import-export company. So it really makes him think also in personal terms, not just in nationalist political thinking, but also in personal terms, let me prepare for what comes afterwards. And with the UANC clearly being in a position of, and choosing to be in a position of negotiating rather than choosing to fight for liberation, he probably saw that as a better alternative for his own choices at that point of time. What I suspect, though, what were important factors that contributed. One was that in 1975, Herbert Chitepo was assassinated. And leading up to that, from 74, there were a series of assassinations. And ethnically, the Mutasas are Manika. And there was this feeling, and it's reiterated in interviews today, that there was a purge going on. Ethnic cleansing was going on, getting rid of Manika nationalists within the party. Now, I don't have direct evidence from the time from KID where he writes, you know, I feared, but there was an assassination attempt by the party against him when he was in Lusaka in 1968, which he barely escaped. So he knew he had enemies within the party, and I strongly suspect that this was leading up to him feeling he wanted to continue with the Student Trust. That was his big political project and incredibly successful. But he did not feel safe in the party any longer.
Was he related to Didymus Mutasa, who remains a ZANU, shall we say, stalwart or henchman, whichever word you want to use?
That Didymus Mutasa, he's from Makuni, and they just stole our name. They have no bloodline with us. No, they're not related.
I'll take another round of questions. Is there one more question? We have one last question because we have to leave the room. So.
Thank you so much for the lecture. I find it very, very interesting. I was just wondering if it's sort of why KID left Black Consciousness Movement and Africanism, and also perhaps more broadly out of curiosity why this Pan-Africanism sort of failed in a way, or how it, why didn't that take off? That's a very broad question.
And a difficult one, I might say. May I be a little unfair to your question and turn it around, why was it effective? Because I was amazed to find, and I only found this out this January, that he took the family every week to these similar meetings. And it really influenced particularly his eldest son, and but also his daughters. And part of it was you wear your hair naturally. So it was a cultural movement as much as a political movement. And some of that, it struck me, but I don't have solid evidence yet, amazingly also goes hand in hand a little bit with the Methodist teaching they grew up with, saying, be a woman and man in your natural self, close to God, which of course is not part of, Fasimba also had a theological element, but they went to meetings where Pan-Africanists from all over came together very regularly as well here in London. And I can only see the attraction and saying, well, we are speaking the same language. We are visionaries, we have big ideas, and this is where we can exchange them. Whereas within the party itself, it's all geared towards, we want to achieve independence. It's geared towards, it's anti-colonial violence, we know what we are against. In a way, it's very circumscribed anti-colonial nationalism. But those were spaces and places of great ideas. I think turning away part of it, and I'm not sufficiently familiar with Fasimba yet, so this is ongoing research, it seems the radicalization and the move into militancy. And I think that was something that especially Joyner was absolutely opposed to. But it definitely influenced the whole family to have these very open, passionate discussions. And I think, being fair to your question, I hope, to your question now, that was also part of why there were limits to the success. Because as much as these meetings were engaging, and you know, poetry readings, prayer meetings. You know, it was big and it was radical and it was out there. But there was also not a concrete agenda on how to bring about political change in a specific place. That, in the end, always came back to party politics. So, you know, it's a more guess than an informed answer I'm giving you here. Thank you.
Okay, all I can say is, judging from the attentiveness to you throughout the time and the very few questions you've got, just shows that the audience have basically absorbed and are still absorbing. If we had some 2 more hours to go, I could tell you 90% of that could be just listening to you. And historians have a way of just explaining and sharing storytelling, which makes you just want to listen and take the nationalist narrative. And I think that's what we're going to actually go away with, knowing that we've had a pleasant evening just listening to an experienced person share the story in a national narrative. So with a round of applause, shall we?
The Association for the Study of Ethnicity and Nationalism is an interdisciplinary student-led research association founded by research students and academics in 1990 at the London School of Economics and Political Science. We seek to fulfil 2 broad objectives: to facilitate and maintain an interdisciplinary global network of researchers, academics, and other scholars interested in ethnicity and nationalism, and to stimulate, produce, and diffuse world-class research on ethnicity and nationalism. We do this through our global membership. Our 2 leading journals, Nations and Nationalism and Studies in Ethnicity and Nationalism, our newsletter, The Ruritanian, which provides key updates on information in the field, and through our programme of events. Our YouTube channel features videos from our annual conferences, seminar series, lectures and debates. You can find us online at lse.ac.uk/ASIN, on Twitter at ASIN Events, or on Facebook at facebook.com/ASIN Events.